us this evening is somebody who tells a very different story. And he's going to share with us for about the next 25, 30 minutes something of that story, something of his journey, having been diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma nearly 6 years ago. He's told the story of that in a book that's already been published called Riddance, which is here. And if you'd like to buy a copy, I'm sure Adam would be delighted to sell you one in a minute, or in an hour or so. He's going to be reading some poems from that and talking about his story. And he's shortly to have another book published, which is much more about kind of journaling his time from being diagnosed, and he'll tell you more of that story. And the book's called Love For Now, and is going to be published in about a month's time,
yeah,
around there. So, we'll have time to listen to Anthony, and we'll have then time to ask questions and engage with some debating him afterwards. Please would you welcome with me now Anthony Wilson.
So it's great to be here. Thank you for coming. I'm just going to read and talk. Just read and talk. That's all I'm going to do. And I'm mostly reading from this book, which Andrew mentioned, which is called Riddance. And I'll start right at the beginning. I'll just describe what happened on January the 1st in 2006. So January the 1st, obviously New Year's Day, we woke up a bit late. And I had this really bad pain down this side, my right-hand side. And I was, you know, sort of really, you know, sort of wobbling around the house like this. And you can imagine the level of sympathy that was going around the house on January the 1st, saying, I feel a bit under the weather. And but it really was not good. And I felt like I'd sort of slept in a draft or something, you know, the door had been open, or I'd slept, doubled up. And it wasn't to do with the excesses of the night before. This became apparent because it just wasn't going away. So by the end of that evening, on January the 1st, 2006, I was in A&E, sort of asking, you know, the doctors to just give me anything that would take the edge off this pain. And they said, well, Mr. Wilson, we think you're in pain, but we don't think it's... we don't think you're in enough pain for it to be kidney stones, because I thought it was kidney stones. And I know people who've had kidney stones. My brother's had kidney stones, and he says, you weren't rolling around on the floor. So it wasn't kidney stones. But they didn't know what it was. So they sent me away with lots and lots of very strong painkillers. And then one thing led to another. And by the end of that first week in January 2006, I was back in hospital on the advice of my GP, in still lots more pain. To cut a very long story short, 6 or so weeks later, on Valentine's Day, they told me formally, by this time I'd had lots of tests and biopsies and so on, and they formally told me on Valentine's Day in 2006 that I had something called non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which I'd never heard of before, not really. I'd heard of the word lymphoma, but I didn't know what it was. And it turns out that although I was hurting a bit here on my side, the tumour that I had was right here. And it was the reason I was in pain was because it was pressing on my urethra, which I believe is some sort of tube. I don't know. Apparently it's connected to your bladder, is that right? Okay. And apparently there's stacks of nerve endings in that part of your body. And so it was actually a very good place, as the doctors kept telling me. It's a really good place, Mr. Wilson. I'm so pleased it's there, because it's pressing on all the nerve endings, and otherwise we may not have found it. Actually, you're lucky. So, it's odd being told that you have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It's an aggressive cancer. But you're really lucky we found it. So you can imagine where this is going. You know, I became very interested on day one of this formal diagnosis in language and the way that we talk about things, and relating to cancer and the language of disease in general. So that's the overarching story. There's lots more to say, but I'll begin with a poem which is at the front of the book, which is talking as though this tumour was like a person. It's just a form of direct address. It's not a new idea. You know, if you think about Keats doing it with Ode to Autumn, you know, he's talking to Autumn, or the Grecian urn. or Shelley to the Western Wind and so on. It's not a very new idea. So I'm just addressing this tumour. And there's just a couple of references in here. One is to an indie band called This Mortal Coil, and another one to a jazz saxophonist. It was great to hear Donna Summer as we came in, called Grover Washington Jr. Tumor. You gave me time to notice. Apple blossom, hand movements, the lights taking leave of rooms. I would like to claim new attention to my children, but the truth is they grew up, whether I watched them or not. Mostly I slept. You began in midsummer. It took till February to find you. By then, all I knew were symptoms, insomnia, night sweats, a cough I could not shake off. Because of you, I revisited old LPs. I did not want to die, not having fried onions to Grover, made bubbles to This Mortal Coil. The script writers of Frasier helped me recover from you, plus condensed milk and broccoli, though not at the same time. Eventually, I drank coffee again. You reacquainted me with my guilt, the way I glared at S after she'd poured out her heart in the autumn of endless nights with nothing but the wind for company. I chose songs having you and invented ceremonies by rivers, but I found no poetry in you. You saved me from talking about house prices. You obliterated my craving for alcohol. I would say I'm grateful, but I'm not ready for that just yet. So I want to say at the beginning that everything that's in this book, give or take a few things, but nearly everything in it is actually after the event. So I wasn't able to concentrate on poetry. Hence, I found no poetry in you. I wrote the poems afterwards, so the book of poems is very retrospective. And the other book that Andrew mentioned, Love for Now, which is coming out in a few weeks, I'll read a couple of extracts from right at the end. And I kept that's a diary, that's a journal that I kept during the time when I was being treated, just to kind of record what was going on and what was happening inside my body. And one of the things, as I've already hinted, one of the things I became really interested in is the way that generally in the culture, just generally in the culture here in this country, we address this issue of cancer and a disease in general, but particularly cancer, I think. And I mean, it's happened even since I've published this book. You know, somebody has, some famous person, usually a footballer or an actress or an actor or somebody has died or will die. Dot, 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 and the newsreader will say, after a short battle with cancer, or dot, 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 after a long battle with cancer. And it's that word battle. And this just totally, I used it myself. I'd never thought about it, just, you know, unconsciously. And I became really interested in that, because I have to say that the last thing you feel like when you get home from a day on the chemotherapy drip is like that you're in some sort of battle. You feel the battle is being done to you, not that you are doing the battle. And the other element of this that interests me is that we use that word, and it almost becomes, we use it and it becomes like it's the responsibility of the person who's ill to get better. And I don't really go along with that. And then you've got the issue of, well, what about if you don't survive? Does that mean you're weak or morally, you know, responsible for dying? You know, so it gets into all sorts of trouble. And that's a big, complex issue, but the way I've addressed it in this book of poems is to do almost like a sort of child's rhyme dealing with that issue. And it's just, it's called I Am Fighting, and it just plays with that. It's a recursive pattern that I use in the poem, which will become very clear as I read it. I am fighting. I am fighting. We are talking. In a room across a table. You are waiting. I am fighting down a corridor in an armchair. You are reading. in a ward across the bed where I am fighting. I am sleeping, imagining, dreaming, flying, running. I am fighting. I am waking, stretching, yawning, on the sofa. You are crying. We are walking through a doorway. I am sitting. Now I'm lying. I am sleeping. You are sitting. We are waiting. I am fighting. So I became almost obsessed with this notion of how we address that. And one of the things I've tried to do in this book is to try and find, if you like, stories that are outside of my story. My story, obviously, is, you know, I know it's inside out. But one of the great, I think, resources of poetry that poetry has is to be able to find and try and locate other narratives that are to do with you and at the same time not to do with you. And I thought it would be appropriate, given the building that we're in and given the service that we've just taken part in, to read this poem, which is a story directly out of the Gospels, which I'm sure will be known to all of you. The story, which I still find really curious, about Jesus healing 10 lepers. And we read in the Gospels that there was one leper who came back and said thank you to Jesus after this momentous, life-changing thing had happened in his life. And that's always really troubled me, that, you know, why didn't they all come back? And so what I'm doing in this poem is to sort of play around with the idea, if you like, of leprosy and draw parallels with other diseases in our culture. Jesus heals 10 lepers. We miss just about everything. An AIDS ward doesn't come close, or even an oncology unit with its scarf-headed, goitered women and men with purple necks. Think of a family tree as a blank where your name resided. The no-go area of town, that's home. You despise those you live with, the stumpy, whitening flesh, the stink of rot they can't feel. Don't even think of community. This was evidence of sin, yours or the mother who disowned you, who in any case was known as a whore. Even the healing command, show yourselves to the priest, is cruel, surely a joke pre-Python. You can imagine how the returner felt. He must have gripped Jesus' ankles till they bled. You would think he couldn't wait to leave. And there's that sort of double-edged thing of, you know, that I'm trying to get at in the poem there, of here's this guy, he's been made better, and yet what happens now? Because the rapid thing that you learn about cancer is that it takes over everything you do, eating, sleeping, lying on the bed, addressing your kids. It becomes who you are. And so trying to hold on to something that is not that is actually very difficult. And so adopting, if you like, an identity, a persona with an illness, almost can become like a sort of comfort in some bizarre way. I'm going to read a couple of poems which are slightly less, I suppose, more gentle, perhaps. I will say one thing that I noticed about when I was ill, which is that all the men in my life came up to me and stroked me a bit, which is quite unusual to be stroked by men. And then they would do this and say, well, you didn't have much hair to lose anyway, which is true. And then all the women in my life would come up and touch me and stroke my head and say, haven't you got a gorgeous shaped head? And, you know, it sort of cuts through those barriers. This is the funny thing about it. You know, you're suddenly being stroked by people and it's okay. Whereas 4 days earlier, it wouldn't have been okay. I want to say that chemotherapy is everything that you've heard about it. It's also fantastic for warts. It really, I had a wart on my finger when I was diagnosed. A tiny little wart, but to me it was ginormous. It was on my finger just there. And the wart hasn't come back. It, you know, so fantastic. Thank you, Exeter, Royal Devon and Exeter Hospital. You killed my wart and lots besides. So this is me again addressing my little wart. Wart. You're not much fun, are you, wart? You sit there on my finger hinge proudly. Announcements aren't your style. Rather, you insinuate, fattening stealthily. Little Uluru, time bomb, capsule from another planet. You glare up at me, a word made flesh. One of the things I learned, this was given to me as a bit of advice. I didn't really ask many people for advice, but there was one person who did actually give me the best bit of advice about how to cope with what was going on. Because she had sat through a very close friend of hers' diagnosis and treatment of cancer some years before, which kind of just ended almost around the time I was diagnosed. So she felt she had sort of permission in a way. And it was brilliant advice. And she said, just commit to watching one really frothy, crappy American sitcom every day. Because that will just, you know, even for half an hour, you know, that will just take you a bit out of yourself. And I found myself, I'd always been a fan, you know, I referred in my first poem to Frasier. I'd always loved Frasier. But never really sort of got into it. So I feel like I could go on Mastermind now and answer questions about Frasier. But later on in the illness, I got treated in a different part of the hospital. I was treated for the first bit of my illness because non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is a blood cancer, so I was treated in the hematology unit. But then to finish me off, metaphorically and literally, I was treated in the oncology unit where they just wanted to give me a little extra sort of top-up of radiation to make sure that they'd really nailed it. And it was in that waiting room that I endured watching the choices that other people had made at daytime TV, which obviously weren't my choices. I'm sure you'll all recognise the references in this poem. They're all around us the whole time. To the programmers of daytime television, what exactly were you thinking when you filled our waiting rooms with ER and Holby City reruns? Did you really think our cancers would panic and vanish at the sight of diagnosis murder? That somehow we'd feel better after through the keyhole? How to live longer? Flog it. What we need is beyond mindless. Danger mouse. Wacky races, the hair bear bunch. If you don't know it, Diagnosis Murder is the most spectacularly awful program. It stars, I was going to say the late, but I don't know if he is the late. He probably, I don't know, Dick Van Dyke. You all know Dick Van Dyke. Well, he's ended up making Diagnosis Murder with his son, Barry. I promise you, this is Barry Van Dyke is in Diagnosis Murder. And the premise is that he's a white coated doctor of a very senior age with sort of white, bright white hair, and he walks around this hospital sort of putting his head through curtains and sort of seeing malfeasance everywhere that he looks, and I don't know, it's just appalling and yet gripping at the same time. I became very obsessed, as you can tell, with this. I promise you it's on your telly during the afternoons. So I've referred to trying to find stories that sort of are about, you know, to deal with, if you like, try and find a language which, you know, this is overwhelming stuff in anybody's life, and it's so big. I can't really describe how I thought about writing these things, because for a long time I didn't think I was going to write anything about it at all. But there was so it wasn't until I was better that I was able to read again, because I find that I only write when I'm reading. And one poem, one book of poems that I sort of dived into again was a fabulous book by a man called Tom Gunn, who was a British poet and spent most of his life in California. and he lived in San Francisco, and he documented in an amazing book called The Man with Night Sweats, truly amazing book, the AIDS epidemic in the community that he was living in San Francisco. And one thing I hadn't realized about, if you like, the relationship between some forms of lymphoma and some forms of HIV/AIDS, there is one thing I did know, which is that they both present in some forms with night sweats, and I was really sure why. And the other, which I didn't know, is that in some forms of HIV/AIDS, at the final stages, patients sometimes do get lymphoma, and that's the thing that finally finishes them off. So I felt like I needed to respond to Tom Gunn's work. Tom Gunn, in that particular poem, in that particular book, wrote in very tight syllabic forms, a number of syllables on each line, and also with very tight rhymes, and I felt that was a sort of, I felt duty-bound to try and answer him and appropriate some of those forms. So this is my homage to that and answer to that. It's called On Rereading The Man With Night Sweats. Today is Valentine's. Later, they will tell me what I know in my bones. It will not be pretty. Shivering and soaked through, I'm put in mind of you, pacing the floor at dawn, listening for avalanche in skin and sinew which do not seem to change. And yet, you know full well how skin feels when it melts, the sabotage of cells destroying their good host while dining out in hell. Our plagues are cousins, ghost. The curse within our blood can never be proved good. Your rhymes dare me to dream, not of eternal life, that things aren't what they seem, of living in the light long enough to be brave. May it never arrive. I'm going to read one more poem and then read something from this soon-to-be-published new book. This poem is a sort of a very, very retrospective poem, and I'm not 100% sure. It comes right at the end of the book, which is a sort of signal. I said that they were all written retrospectively, but the ones at the end of the book really were written right at the end of the process. And so this is written relatively recently, only about a year ago. And it's just called The Honest Truth. The Honest Truth. I love it when people ask about my health. Not how are you, or how are you really, but tell me how you're keeping. You look terrific, by the way. Sometimes they touch my arm. I want to kiss them on the forehead, wash their feet with my tears, massage their paws with pure nard, a towel strapped to my waist. I want to promise them stars on broken skies, blossom mirrored in a lake. I do not think they want to know about the wave of ice making its way up my arm, be reminded of bone pain, the hours I sometimes lose gazing into space, wondering if I will ever recover or reach a stage when this will leave or make sense. I think they want to know I am happy, that I wake and face each day with gratitude, or at least am returning to who I was before. There is a pause as I look into their eyes, these kind people who cooked meals, gave lifts, sat in silence as they watched me make coffee in return for their flowers. I thank them and say, I'm fine. Relieved, pleased to have been of help, they leave. I cannot tell them what they do not want to hear. The honest truth is, I did not disappear, but think I did sometimes, and want to, even though I look terrific. I promise you, the real book, that when it comes out, is not this big. This is just the proof copy, which I've been correcting. In fact, this is the pre-edited version, so this runs to many, many pages indeed, and it's much slimmer now, which is a good thing, I think. I'm going to read two very short extracts. The book is called Love for Now, and I'll just explain why it's called Love for Now. When I was ill, I think Facebook was just about existing somewhere in America, but it didn't really exist over here. I wasn't using it at any rate. I hadn't heard of it. And not ditto for Twitter. So I wasn't really... The way of staying in touch with people was to email, you know, and texting on the mobile phone. So I did an enormous amount of emailing, so people would email for news. And I remember signing them off. Without thinking, I just got into the habit of signing them off. Love for Now, Ant. And I just thought that was... And about halfway through the illness, I thought, that's telling me something. Because it's like a way of saying goodbye, but it's an imperative. You know, we must love what's in front of us. And that's what the book is really about. It's about just paying attention. And this little passage here is about that. It comes about 3 months in. I've had my chemotherapy, and I don't know what's around the corner. I don't know that I'm going to have radiotherapy. I've survived being told that I was relapsing when I wasn't. So I think I'm going to get better by this stage, but I'm not 100% sure. What I want is to be present. That's what I've learned. I want to strive for presence now, here, in my kitchen, with a Boeing overhead, and later at Morena's prize giving as she collects her award. In my writing, as I listen to the music in a line and as my characters cause each other's damage. In my reading, too, to hear it, feel it, and imagine it as one might, the shock of recognition of Thomas putting his hand in the Lord's side. I want that deep down sense of things, to use Hopkins' phrase. A wild cry of shame in Sheem's voice when he comes in late and when we aren't even angry with him. The laughter and a candlelit table which is both transitory and timeless. To spot words in Shakespeare plays that you didn't know he used, botched, for example. To watch weird dance and good meaty thrillers. To walk on Exmouth Beach on bracing Saturday afternoons and be rugby tackled by your son and his friend. To use trains. To watch the light take leave of a room. To breathe and then breathe again. But to notice it. So it's just a couple of references there to my children who appear throughout the book in different guises and in different forms, who had to live through this thing as much as I did in different ways. So this is the last thing I'm going to read, and then I think we'll invite questions and so on. This is the world premiere of this. I haven't read this anywhere else. Just wanted you to know that. It's not even out yet. This is much earlier in the process. This piece of writing happens about a month into chemotherapy, and I'm feeling absolutely on the floor. I used to describe it as though, do you remember those old cartoons with Daffy Duck? And someone would get out a very, very big plank of wood and just flatten him with it, and he would go completely flat, like sort of paper thin. That's how I felt. When did I get this? Was it there on Christmas Day, as I carved the turkey wearing my lovely stripy shirt given to me for my anniversary? Yes. Was it there when I played football 2 days after Christmas and got bollocked by Pug's friend Adrian because I was slow, useless, had no first touch and let in 3 quick goals? Yes. Was it there when I cooked chicken with lemon and olives for my students? Yes. Was it there when I struggled into work a week later feeling flu-y and everyone said kindly how terrible I looked? Yes. It was there when I burned CDs from the library, and it was there when I lit fireworks in the garden for the kids. It was there when I went to the dump with Sheem, and it was there when Bendy and I shopped in the January sales. which was there at BTP over Latte, and it was there in the family curry. It was there when I cycled to work, and it was there when I strolled round the quay. It was there when I emailed colleagues, and it was there when I sent apologies to meetings. It was there when I lectured students and when we met one to one. It was there in my initials in their files. It was there when I went for bread, when I made love, brought cheese, scanned the sports pages, picked up a poetry book, posted a postcard, had my hair cut, made porridge, called the builder. It was there, uninvited and growing in the dark. I did not ask for it. I did not deserve it. It is not fair. But it found me, and I accepted it. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you.